The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Leffler. I have been for a long time. And our special guest this week is Dr. Jeff Volek on the subject of low-carb diets for both athletes and diabetics. And this is really important because a lot of diabetics don't know how to properly control their diet to reduce symptoms and the progress of the disease. Well, you know what? If you're a parent with children who just graduated or will soon graduate, you're probably thinking about or making plans for college for your kids. Now, of course, graduating from high school, not graduating from college. When kids graduate from college, I think about all the money they're going to pay me back for what I invest.
I don't think it works that way, John.
Wait a minute. Time out. What is this you're springing on me? You mean they don't pay me back for everything? Oh, wow.
No, I'm sorry. There's no refund.
All right. How about a return guarantee?
No, I don't think you get that either.
All right. Anyway, well, if you're one of those parents, your kids are out of high school, you're wondering, what are you going to do here? You're wrestling with what college to choose and what the costs are going to be. At least you should have been doing that all along, as a matter of fact, when your kids were high school seniors. The question is, can you afford to send your kids to the best schools? And will they have a job when they graduate, even if they do go to the best schools? And if you spend all of that money on tuition?
And it goes beyond just the parents, John. And if you are a student listening to this or considering going to college, you may be thinking about the cost of that education. And more importantly, the amount of debt that you will amass by the time you graduate. And more importantly, we're seeing this play out each year here, and especially over the last 8 years. Will you have a job when you graduate from college? So it's not just choosing the right college. It's also the cost of that education. It's the prospects for having a job and the salary that you will earn. And there's a concern there for not just the parents, but the students as well. It's interesting, nationally, we've talked about this, that this has impacted the housing market and this recovery in terms of first-time home buyers, because a lot of couples getting married today are bringing anywhere from $70,000 to $100,000 of debt into that marriage, depending on whether they went to local schools or private. But John, at the end of 2014, the national average of debt is $30,000 for a college student. About 70% of graduates who have left college have an average debt nationally of $28,400. That's some big bucks.
Okay, so what we're going to do on the program today is to address some of these issues, but we'd like to begin with the prospect of where are the jobs after you graduate. I mean, after all, if you spend what is the equivalent of a small fortune becoming educated, theoretically, you would like to make that back. This is a return on your investment, and you'd like to know that you have a job when you graduate in order to do that. So let's look at top-paying jobs for the 2015 collegiate graduates.
You know, there are a number of stats on the job market, but what you really want to do is look at both the demand, the education requirements, and the starting salary ranges. And there was a study that just came out this year, which listed the top 25 jobs in demand and also the fastest growing occupations. Now, it's no surprise, this is the one that really caught me, but it shouldn't surprise anyone. 14 out of the 25 top jobs were in the medical field. And you take a look at everything from diagnostic medical sonographers, occupational therapists, genetic counselors, physical therapy assistants, skin care specialists, physician assistants, that's a growing field, physical therapist, orthotist and prosthetist, audiologist, nurse practitioners. This is almost like a doctor today. I don't know about you, John. Sometimes when I've gone to see the doctor, you don't get to see a doctor. You get to see a nurse practitioner. Medical equipment repairers, biomedical engineers, dietitians, and nutritionists. And, you know, one of the things that really struck me about many of these jobs is many of them require higher education levels. It's not just the bachelor's degree anymore. It's requiring master's degrees, and in some cases, PhDs.
All right, besides the medical field, any other fields that really stand out in your mind in terms of demand for new people entering the marketplace?
I mean, they were pretty widely dispersed. Here's one that probably goes more with this global market that we're in, is one of the second jobs in demand were for interpreters or translators. Other things that we saw in the top 25 were information systems, programmers, to market research analysts, and industrial engineers, especially with the renaissance of manufacturing and pretty much automation of the factory floor. But most of these jobs, John, if there was a common thread that ran throughout them, they were technical and scientific. They all required higher education. They were science, medical backgrounds. The one thing you didn't see there really wasn't a big demand for liberal arts. So a lot of the things that we're seeing where the jobs are very technical in nature. And that's the surprising thing, because how many students went and became English lit majors, liberal arts majors, sociology, a lot of things that there just isn't a demand for, despite the amount of money spent on a college education. We're getting more and more technical, especially as we see technological innovation accelerate every 5 to 7 years. It's not surprising we're seeing more demand for people which are really technically proficient in some form, either engineers, computer programmers, medical technicians, or even in the area of finance today. It's no longer a bachelor's degree. It could be an MBA.
What about pay scales and starting salaries? If we look for the top starting salaries, where would we find those?
Here you find probably the same pattern. It's in the medical and technical field. CNN just published a report on the top 100 careers. Now, we don't have time to cover all of them, but medical, technology, engineering all clearly stand out in terms of demand, pay, and future job growth. And just to give you an idea, right at the very top, software architect, $124,000 a year, 23% job growth. Here's one, well, it wouldn't surprise Gen Xers or millennials, video game designers, almost $80,000 a year starting out with 19% pay growth. Hospital administrator, this fits along with medical, $114,000, 23% job growth. Clinical nurse specialist, almost $89,000. Information assurance analyst, that's $96,000. Here's one I found interesting. Maybe this has a lot to do with our want of getting more fit. Pilates and yoga instructor, gosh, $62,000 a year. Dentist, $152,000. IT program manager, $122,000. Pharmacist, $125,000. Physical therapy, almost $88,000. Emergency room physicians, $274,000. ER guys. Health information management, $81,000. And research and development engineers at $108,000. They had basically the top 100 pay jobs. And John, they were all up there closer to $100,000, many of them well over $100,000. So obviously, you know, as we get more technologically driven, there's greater demand for those skill sets. And they're commanding high salaries starting out with plenty of prospects for growth.
You know, over the last two decades, what we have seen here is that the top jobs are in technology and Wall Street. And with our aging baby boomer population, we could add the medical profession to that. What is really clear is that liberal arts, sociology, history, ethnic studies, very slim job prospects. You have to go look in very specific areas, and that means there's going to be a limited number of opportunities. So it is becoming clear, before you fork over a fortune in educational expense, you should know where the jobs are and what you can expect in a starting salary to start the career in order to pay off those loans and be able to live at the very same time.
The other thing that really struck me as you look at this, it's becoming clear a bachelor's degree is no longer a fast track to, let's say, a big paycheck as they once were, but certain professions still have a significant head start in the years immediately following graduation. Now, you always hear about law school and medical school, but certain professions still stand out. According to a Forbes study, investment banker, starts out at an average salary of $112,000, 9% job growth rate. Right behind there, very close, are software engineers or developers. They start out roughly at an average wage of about $84,000. That's very fast growing today, 30% growth rate in the field. Actuaries, this one surprised me, but these are people that work for insurance companies, come up with statistics in terms of longevity, the probability of accidents, $79,000 a year, 21% job growth. The other one that should come as no surprise, engineers. You get a four-year degree as an engineer, average starting salary $72,000 a year, 11% job growth. Network system administrators, roughly about $70,000 a year, 23% job growth. So there are some jobs that have such high demand that even with a bachelor's degree, you can start out high single figures and then get into the triple digits, for example, investment bankers. But the one trend that is increasingly becoming clear is you look at many of these jobs where the skill sets, they're demanding higher and higher levels of education. Even in the area of finance, you might graduate with a degree in business or, let's say, finance with a bachelor's degree, but you want to make it on Wall Street, MBAs and CFAs are now almost a standard requirement that you see in the field.
Well, I think the common link here is more scientific specific rather than general. If you sum it up, the top three or four professions, technology, medical, engineering, and finance. Now, are there any differences in jobs and pay between men and women? You know, we always collect statistics on this type of thing.
You know, Forbes just released a study on the top jobs for women. I found it rather fascinating in terms of what the top jobs are. A lot of similarities. The top job was sales engineers. Now, I don't know what a sales engineer is. You're obviously doing something in sales in some kind, $134,000. Now, here's one, math and science for women, $129,000. Boy, that sounds like a college professor job to me. Or maybe you're working for a pharmaceutical company. Astronomer and physicist was another one for women, $119,000. A nurse anesthetist, $114,000. Now, here's one that'll surprise you, especially for women. Petroleum engineer. Think of all the fracking and horizontal drilling and the U.S. energy renaissance, $105,000. Other popular jobs, pharmacist, almost $100,000. Nuclear technician, $91,000. Architectural and engineering managers, $90,000. Economist, here's a big one for women, $89,000. Nurse practitioner, that's almost close to $90,000. Aerospace engineers, I know that for a fact. I have a daughter-in-law who has one, and she got a great job starting out of college with a four-year degree with multiple job offers, $80,000 starting out there. Computer information science, roughly about $80,000. So a lot of similarities. You'll notice very, very, very technical is where we're going. And that's one of the things that drives the U.S. economy is not only it's a service-based economy, but also our technological prowess, whether it's in the field of energy, medicine, or industrial engineering now.
Okay, now that we've looked at top jobs and where the demand and pay is, what we need to do is move on to education itself, the best colleges, the cost of getting a degree to get those jobs, also the question whether or not you really need to go to a top college in a particular area other than, say, for example, if you have a real specialized field where the professorship in a particular college is really trained in that. When you think about it, they all generally use the same theories and textbooks. Do you really need that? Is that really going to play a role?
You know, this is something that I found rather fascinating because we're going to talk about the top colleges for 2015, but then we're also going to talk about the colleges you can actually afford. And when you're getting into specifics and you're talking about, I don't care if it's technology, if it's medical, you know, you become a doctor or you become a medical specialist. You know, obviously, you come from a pedigree like Harvard or Stanford or something. Obviously, you're not going to have trouble getting the job. But I think if you go to a school that just doesn't happen to be an A school, you're still getting a job. It's interesting because Money just released their top colleges for 2015. And they talked about the price of an education, the average cost with, let's say, college aid and student debt upon graduation. Listeners, prepare yourself, because this kind of shocked me. The cost were really shocking, because we've talked about here on the program, you're probably looking at $18,000 to $20,000 if you go to, let's say, a state college. And then probably $40,000 to $50,000 is the national average if you go to a private college. What I found is when you take a look at these top schools, it's much, much higher than that. Let's begin with the number one college in the country, according to the Money Poll, was Stanford University. Now, here's the sticker shock. $280,126 for a Stanford education. The estimated price for those who receive college aid, that's aid now you're getting, is still close to almost $100,000. The average student debt upon graduation, a little over $32,000. Average career earnings starting out, $64,000. Now, when I saw the Stanford one, I thought, gosh, that really stood out. But if you take a look at the top 10, their second choice was Babson College. The sticker for that education, $267,000. Cost, even with college aid, about $116,000. Average student debt upon graduation, $12,000. Average pay scale. Now, I want to talk about pay scale when you come out, was $60,100. We had Princeton University in the number three spot at roughly $249,000. $91,000 was student aid, and average career earnings, $60,500. In the number five spot, California Institute of Technology, that was roughly $265,000. $116,000 was student aid. Pay scale, now that's funny, you know, once again, we're getting into technology. Average pay scale was much higher, $72,300. And of course, we've got to throw Harvard in there. Harvard, the average sticker shock was almost $169,000. They have a tremendous endowment plan. So with student aid, it's around $77,000. Here's a surprising thing. The average pay scale, roughly about $60,000. So even some of the top and most expensive schools were not the highest starting average pay over a lifetime career. For example, you get to Harvey Mudd College. Never heard of it, but the average pay over a lifetime is $76,400. Maine Maritime Academy average pay is $67,000. And here it was more reasonable because it was $115,000 for a degree. But John, this gets back to this point that we were talking about of just because you went to Harvard or Stanford, it didn't necessarily translate into, you know, megabucks when you started your career. So let's say you were an engineer and you got a degree from, I suppose if you went to MIT, that would probably get you a higher starting salary. But the surprise was the average range between these top 10 schools was $280,000 to $250,000. So the average yearly cost is not that $40,000 to $50,000. It's closer to $60,000 to $70,000. Now, imagine if you're a parent, you got three Einsteins in the family that could get into these kind of schools. You better hope they get college aid because it brings down the cost. But you know, at $260,000 to $280,000 a pop, wow, we're talking about like buying a house for each kid.
Well, you either better have lots of bucks, get a scholarship or student aid to attend some of these tuition fee colleges. Now, what about schools that actually more fit the budget? That's the question that I asked earlier. Do you really need this top college? Is that going to affect your getting a job? Because you learn the subject, you learn the subject. Except with that, I understand the differences where certain schools specialize in certain things. Okay, but if you have the right degree, I would suspect that you still have a great chance of getting the right job and a good salary. So let's look at college costs that are really more practical.
Yeah, in addition to the money survey of the top 10 colleges and their cost in the country, they also did a survey called the 50 Best Colleges that you can actually get into. Now, this is very important if you're a parent out there, because these are colleges that are affordable according to the money survey. They're saying, are the elite colleges a long shot? Well, whether you're a B or C student hoping for a great education, or a stronger student in search of a, let's say, safety school, these top colleges accept at least close to 66% of applicants are definitely worth a look. And this will give you an example. I just talked about schools that cost between $260,000 and $280,000. These are schools that are definitely more affordable. One of the top ones is Texas A&M at College Station, Texas. Value added grade, B plus according to Money, 79% graduation rate. Net price of the degree, $84,732. Average career earnings of roughly $54,000. Let's look at a couple other ones. University of Washington, Bothell campus in Bothell, Washington. Value added grade A, graduation rate 64%. Net price of the degree, roughly about $127,000. Average career earnings of $51,500. Another one, which got national attention because of basically tragic events, Virginia Polytechnic Institute at Blacksburg, Virginia, B plus value added grade, 83% graduation rate, roughly about $117,000 for a cost of degree, career earnings around $54,000. Another one, Martin Luther College in Minnesota, A rated, 76% graduation rate. Cost of the degree, $88,543. I wonder what they specialize, because the career earnings didn't look too good, about less than $32,000. So not real big there. But, you know, money did this at these various schools, and it fits in more with what we've talked about. When you're going to a state school, first of all, you're probably more likely to get an acceptance rate versus trying to get into, let's say, MIT, Harvard, Wharton, or Stanford, or Princeton, or one of the top Ivy League schools. Easier to get into, especially if you're a high B student versus, you know, outstanding SAT scores and, you know, 4.0 grade average. But the cost, get down to that figure that we talked about, closer to that $20,000 to $25,000 range, where you're going to get total cost for the degree between $80,000 and $100,000 versus $250,000 to $280,000. And I mean, if you think about that, John, that was the one that really shocked me. I kept thinking, you know, Harvard, $40,000, probably closer to $50,000, when it was closer to $70,000.
Well, as we sum up for this whole thing, then, you know, it's very, very clear that before you head off to college, you want to look at where the greatest top prospects are, because ultimately you want to be able to get a job when you graduate. Theoretically, that's the purpose of it. So the first step in this process is to research where the greatest demand is for the high-paying jobs, and then decide the field most of interest to you with inside that high paying area. After that, examine colleges that we could say are affordable, because you don't want a mountain of debt when you graduate from college. It's like trying to run a race with a big weight strapped to your foot. It doesn't always work if you're trying to keep up with everything else. And you hear about these horror stories, Jim, of people just accumulating $100,000 plus debt. I go, that's insane. How will you ever pay that off? That's almost that you've bought a house and you haven't even bought a house.
Yeah. I mean, you think of people that go to law school, or, you know, doctors that go to not just a 4-year degree, but 3 years of medical school, 4 years if you're becoming a specialist, and then the number of years you work as an internship. So you not only want to look at where the jobs are, but find a field where you have some interest. You know, it's not going to do you any good, and you're not going to be a happy person if, well, here's where all the jobs are, but you're really not interested in doing that kind of work. So then once you find out where the jobs are and something that you really like, you want to find the best affordable college to equip you for getting that job. And I've always been, as we've talked here on the program, a big proponent of what I call the 2+2 program, which is basically 2 years at a junior college and 2 years at a state school. And you can get the cost of that education down in that $40,000 to $50,000 range, not the $80,000 to $100,000 range. And I'm also a big believer, and you're seeing this more and more, of alternatives. For example, you get out of high school, you work, and you get your degree online. So you not only have work experience that you can bring in this. Wouldn't it be nice to get in or work, get some work experience that makes you more valuable to your employer, but also find out if you're going to like the work that you're going to do? I know in the case of a couple of my sons, one son wanted to be a vet, worked for a vet, decided that wasn't it, then went to work in the R&D program at a drug company that led to his degree in science, but then found out that the pay scale and the jobs weren't there, then obviously changed the profession. But what you really want to do is find the field, and when you graduate, graduate with no or very little debt. I mean, I think, John, that, you know, when you start talking about some of these costs, $280,000, I mean, what is it going to be at Harvard 10 years from now? Is it going to be $500,000 for a four-year degree at Harvard? And then you want to go on to get a master's degree? I mean, are we going to be talking someday spending $750,000 for a PhD at some of these top-name schools? And I think this whole education paradigm is going to change. I think you're going to see more towards the 2+2 paradigm that I talked about. Working and getting a job online is another paradigm shift. And also, big corporations associating or coming up with what I call specialty programs at junior colleges, where you get some kind of specialty certificate or designation. You're seeing this in the medical field. You're starting to see it in the industrial field. You see a lot of this, however, in the medical field now, where you come out and go to a junior college with a two-year certification, whether it's the nursing field or some kind of assistant in the medical field, John. But I think more and more you're going to see education move to these kind of paradigms, because I don't know, even, you know, if Larry Lots of Bucks can afford three kids at Stanford, especially if they go on. Another trend that we found out, it's not just that we're seeing these more specialized skill sets that are required today, but many of these jobs are going beyond the four-year degree. They're requiring master's degrees, you know, MBAs, master's degree, in many cases, PhDs to get these jobs. Yes, they're great paying, but you can imagine what the cost of education is if you have to get a master's degree on top of the bachelor's or even a PhD. So personally, I think you're just going to see that the paradigm shifts, because it leaves you at least, you know, when you go, whether it's 2+2, work and get a job online, that leaves you with the least amount of debt when you graduate. And you see so much of this on the national level we've talked about here, of so much debt levels here, and how many students that are going to college incurring enormous amounts of debt, but they're getting degrees and things that don't have jobs waiting for them when they get out. And one of the big issues facing the country right now, and especially since the financial crisis, where a lot of people stayed in school, got further education, is the massive amount of student loans, many of which don't have good prospects for being paid off.
So to summarize everything up, number one, you really need to research what jobs are out there and what professions are going to get you the most yield. Get some work experience is very, very important. Evaluate the cost of education that is the most affordable, and look at alternative options to minimize your cost and especially the debt. Okay. You have to target what outcome you want to reach in terms of jobs, the amount of indebtedness you're willing to incur to get there, and how much you expect to return on that, and how easy it will be to pay off. And of course, that's related to the salary that you deserve and the education that you can afford. Okay, it's time now to discuss this week's case study. As always, our case studies are based on real life cases, but we changed the names to protect the privacy of the people involved.
Yeah, this is a case, I think we talked about this case a little over a year ago, but I wanted to bring it up again because I think it reflects a situation that many families find themselves in. We'll call this the case of Joe and Kathy Simpson. Joe was an engineer at Qualcomm, Kathy a dental hygienist. Second marriage, Kathy had two children from her previous marriage and one from their own. Here was the issue. Their oldest daughter, Jennifer, had a high SAT score, 4.0, in addition to a high SAT score. She got accepted to USC at a cost of roughly about $50,000 a year. The issue at hand here was they only had roughly about $30,000 saved up, which were mainly gifts from Kathy's parents. And here's the issue. Jennifer wanted to be a teacher. So if you take a look at the cost of the education, 4 years at 50 grand a pop is $200,000 for a job as a teacher that would start out at roughly $40,000 a year. Now, there simply wasn't the assets there to pay for this, so somebody was going to have to go into debt, either both Jennifer's parents, Joe and Kathy, or Jennifer herself along with her parents. Because if we take a look at their assets, they had a home worth about $900,000 with about $500,000 mortgage. They were looking at maybe possibly taking a second on the home. We'll get into that in a second. Joe had a 401k program worth about $600,000 plus additional $100,000 in company stock. Kathy's 401k program, roughly about $90,000. IRAs, roughly about $40,000, roughly about $20,000 in savings. And here was one of the options, since they had equity in the home, taking out a second mortgage. Two, Jennifer would take out student loans. And three, go to a junior college for 2 years, a state school for 2 years. And this were the three options. And we've seen this over and over again. You know, if you got a bright Einstein in the family, and you know, your kid gets accepted to Harvard, Stanford, MIT, what parent wouldn't be proud to say, oh my goodness, my child got accepted to one of the nation's top colleges? But there's the reality, as we just talked about before this case study, of what the cost is, anywhere from $250,000 to $280,000. That's a lot of money.
Okay, so there we had three options. What happened?
You know, in the end, they went for option three. They managed to convince their daughter that taking out a $150,000 line of credit on the home wasn't in their best interest. 12 years before Joe retired, the last thing he wanted to do, they already had a $500,000 mortgage, you know, adding another $150,000 onto the mortgage because they already had close to $30,000 saved up. And it just didn't make a lot of sense. And they didn't have enough to meet their retirement goals. So if they did that, they weren't going to retire. They were going to have to work longer. So they met with their daughter and explained, look, you know, it's great that you got into this school, but it's going to cost $200,000. We don't have the money to do this, which means you're going to have to take on a lot of debt. And, you know, when you start with your degree teaching, you're going to start out here in California roughly at about $40,000 in income. Is that really worth $150,000 of debt? And, you know, they also explained their own situation and why option one, taking out a second mortgage, especially with two other kids to get educated, didn't really make a lot of sense. And also, you know, would she want to basically have six figures worth of debt starting out her career, and what that would mean starting out and getting married? Can you imagine bringing 150 grand of debt into a marriage, enormous amount of debt, unlikely to be able to afford a home like their parents? And, you know, it'd probably take 10 to 15 years to pay down that debt. So in the end, you know, look, if you're going to go teach, you know, if you went to just a state school versus a private school, your starting salary isn't going to be above $40,000. They're not going to say, oh, you went to Stanford? We'll start you out at $60,000, $75,000 as a starting teacher instead of $40,000. So the practicalities of this finally came home to roost. And it was the right decision to make. It was cheaper. In fact, Jennifer lived at home and worked while attending junior college. And then that way, the money that they had saved up in the 529 plans, plus Kathy's parents still contributing to those plans, would pay for those final 2 years of school at a state college.
All right. So if you're a parent whose kids are going to be headed to college, hopefully not in the near future, the longer you plan, the better off you are. That's lesson number one. Start saving early. Number two, make the right investments in doing that as part of your saving so that you get the maximum yield for what you're saving. And part of that is number three, tax minimization schemes such as the 529 plans. Also, you have to evaluate, number four, the cost of education versus what you anticipate getting back from it in salaries. And then, having done all of that, five, remember that you need to evaluate as well the alternatives that you could employ, not just paying tuition flat outright, but working and going to school simultaneously, scholarships, grants, everything else that could be factored into that. All of those things help you get through education. Now, coming up next, Dr. Jeff Volek, low-carb diets for both athletes and diabetics. And if you're interested in losing weight, this will probably pertain to you as well, because typically high-carb diets put on a lot of poundage. All of that as Lifetime Income continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his lifetime income specialists, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, lifespans in the U.S. have gone up over the last couple decades. The average male can live in his 80s and women into their mid-80s. But despite longevity, Americans are leading the world in diseases such as heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. Could diet be the solution? Joining me on the program is Dr. Jeff Volek. He's a full professor in the Department of Human Sciences at Ohio State University. You know, doctor, since I have been around, we have seen all kinds of fads when it comes to diets, the Mediterranean diet, the South Beach diet, the Atkins diet, the paleo diet, vegan, vegetarian. What is it with diets that we can't come to some universal agreement that there is definitely one kind of diet that is good for all of us, or is it really dependent on the person?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Jim. That's a great question. I think part of the answer is people do vary quite a lot between each other when it comes to the ideal diet that works for them. So there really is no cookie cutter approach when it comes to nutrition that works across the board for everyone. And we're still at the level of basic science trying to understand how we can figure out which diet works best for which people. And we're starting to move the needle a bit in that area and have a little bit of an understanding of how we can start to tailor diets for people. But our understanding is still pretty crude.
You know, one thing that I've seen, and it's been explained, that even in the medical field, doctors, when they're going through medical school, have very little background or take few classes on nutrition. What do you think that is?
Well, that's true. My understanding is most physicians have at most one class in nutrition, and that class is probably pretty basic information. You know, so there's certainly a lack of training and knowledge amongst most physicians out there when it comes to the complexities of, you know, using nutrition as a therapeutic tool.
So when we take a look at the various diets out there, some you got to measure your carbs or measure your portions. And we all know, doctor, that's very difficult for Americans to do. I mean, it would be nice if you just ate a certain way and the diet would work. I want to talk about something that is becoming increasingly popular, whether you're looking at, call it low-carb diets, or you're looking at something like the paleo diet. Explain why these diets have become more effective. People are losing weight. They're seeing their blood chemistry levels improve. What is it about a low-carb diet that makes it work so well?
Well, what many people are suffering from is a term I like to use is carbohydrate intolerance. And they're consuming more carbohydrates than their body can metabolize in a healthy way. You know, so for many people, they're over-consuming sugars and starches in their diet. And when you ask them to remove some of those carbohydrates from their diet, many of their problems get better. So many of these diets, whether it's paleo or Atkins or even Mediterranean diets, have the common theme of being lower in carbohydrates. So for many people, they bring their carbs down below the level that they can tolerate, and they experience weight loss. They're more satiated. A lot of their metabolic problems improve, so much so that even type 2 diabetics can completely reverse their condition when you really get the diet right. So, you know, what's happening in this country now is we're over-consuming carbohydrate. It's not that we're over-consuming energy per se. It's specifically, you know, we're consuming too many unhealthy forms of carbohydrate. And so any diet approach that addresses that fundamental problem tends to work well.
You talk about the body's metabolism can healthfully and safely adapt to a low-carbohydrate diet longer term. Explain that.
Well, from an evolutionary perspective, you know, 98-99% of human history, we ate a diet that was pretty low in carbohydrate and much higher in fat than we do today. So from that perspective, you know, we've evolved to be able to survive, if not thrive, on a diet that had, you know, limited amounts of carbohydrate. It's only since the advent of agriculture where we've had greater exposure to a lot of grains and carbohydrates, and even a shorter amount of time that we've been exposed to sugars. And our bodies haven't had time to adapt to those types of diets. So there's a decent percentage of us in the U.S. and on this planet, you know, who really don't tolerate, you know, high amounts of sugars and starches. But we retain the ability to adapt to a diet that's very low in carbohydrate because it's just naturally part of how we're hardwired.
You know, I've read some of your books, and I've learned from your books that there is a big difference between something called nutritional ketosis that comes from following a low-carb diet and ketoacidosis, commonly seen in diabetics. Can you explain that?
Well, that's right. The term ketosis has kind of been maligned over the years because it's associated with ketoacidosis, and that is a very dangerous condition that occurs in individuals who do not make insulin, and that's type 1 diabetics. So in that particular subgroup of individuals, if they are uncontrolled, they can experience very life-threatening effects from these very high levels of ketones that occur in the body. But when you ask a person who's not insulin insufficient to restrict carbohydrates, one of the early responses or adaptations to that is they begin to break down fat rapidly and produce ketones. And this is a much milder state of ketosis. And in this range of ketone levels, it's actually an optimal metabolic state to be in, where the ketones are an entire order of magnitude lower than they are in ketoacidosis. But they're an order of magnitude higher than they are in the normal carb-fed state. So it's kind of a sweet spot of nutritional ketosis where you're getting optimal fuel flow, especially for the brain. The brain prefers to use ketones for fuel, and it's a much more stable or sustainable fuel source, you know, for the brain, which consumes a lot of energy. You know, even in a resting individual, it's burning close to 600 kcals a day. So this is a normal adaptation that occurs in starvation, but it also occurs when you're just restricting carbohydrates and not total energy.
You know, Doctor, you wrote and provided references that current evidence shows no association between dietary saturated fat and cardiovascular disease, because you talk to most people and you see some of the ads on television. If you have heart disease, they tell you to stay away from fats. What accounts for this?
Yeah, well, the whole concern around saturated fat that's been the cornerstone of our dietary guidelines for the last 3.5 decades is sort of being reevaluated and turned upside down, if you will. And in terms of the low-carb diet, there continues to be a concern because people eat more fat on that diet and they eat more saturated fat. And so it's been a focus of our research to try to understand how the diet may be changing a person's risk factors for heart disease, including saturated fat levels. And I guess the, you know, important point for your listeners is that when you're adapted to a low-carb diet, your body becomes very proficient at burning saturated fat for fuel. So even if you're eating more, your body's simply taking that saturated fat that you're consuming and oxidizing it or burning it for fuel. So it's not accumulating in your arteries or it's not accumulating in your hips where it may cause problems. It's actually being used as a fuel, which is a good thing. So it's hard to imagine it causing any long-term harm if it's simply being used by your cells for energy. And that's what we've shown now in multiple studies.
Doctor, explain for me. I remember in my younger days when I went out for sports, football, track, wrestling, that I consume vast quantities of carbohydrates, everything from pizza to pasta, and, you know, never gained any weight. Now, later on, when I decided I wanted to get back into shape, I started working out, I got hungry, and I was eating carbs. I didn't lose weight. What about, like, athletes? Have you found a difference between, let's say, somebody that is training for the Olympics that is obviously burning vast amounts of calories in their training, in your average American who just, you know, gets up in the morning, goes to work, comes home, and lives a normal life?
Yeah, great question. You know, in parallel with the increased recognition that a low-carb diet may be ideal for diabetics, and for managing weight, you also have a growing legion of athletes, in particular these ultra endurance athletes who are doing marathon and triathlon and beyond type activities. And historically, they've been told they need carbs and they need lots of carbs and carb load before events. And that's been the prevailing wisdom for 3 or 4 decades. But now you have a group of these athletes who have switched to a low-carb diet, and they're not just able to exercise, and there's many examples now of low-carb, fat-adapted athletes who are winning races and setting course records. And so they're really challenging the conventional wisdom around, you know, the obligate nature of carbohydrate for athletes. And it makes a lot of sense. I mean, these athletes, if they're dependent on carbs, you know, they don't store many carbs in their body, so they have to constantly eat these gels and sports drinks to continue to provide the needed carbs to exercise. But if you become fat adapted, they get very good at burning fat, including their own body fat, for fuel. And there's a lot more energy in body fat than there is glycogen or carbohydrate in the body. So they have an almost limitless amount of fuel they can tap into when they're performing these multiple hours of exercise to do their training and their events. So that's the metabolic sort of value. There's also probably health effects associated with this that we're just starting to understand too, because many of these athletes do go on to develop diabetes despite the fact they're very active if they have a strong genetic predisposition for that. And so they find they need to limit carbs for those reasons as well. Many of them claim they recover faster when they're limiting carbs. So there could be other self-perceived benefits and indirect benefits of the diet that go beyond just, you know, the ability to use their fat more efficiently for fuel during exercise.
Is there any case where a low-carb diet may not be appropriate? In other words, I've read there are certain people that have certain blood types, and certain blood types do better under certain diets. Have you found that in your research, that based on a person's blood type, they may not do as well on, let's say, a low-carb diet?
Well, there's very few contraindications, so most people can certainly adapt to a low-carb diet and not have any concerns. That doesn't mean everyone needs to follow a low-carb diet, because there's certainly a percentage of the population that does quite well eating a fairly high-carbohydrate diet. But that's probably only about a quarter of the population, because statistics tell us now that 2/3 of us are overweight, 1/3 are obese, probably 1/3 have prediabetes. So those are the ones who need to limit carbs, because they're the group that has carbohydrate intolerance. So the majority of Americans probably would do much better to focus on limiting carbs than they would limiting fat in the diet. And it's probably a quarter of the population that doesn't need to worry about limiting carbs or fat. They do quite well on either diet.
Doctor, are there certain kinds of tests that people can take that can be preventative when it comes to diabetes? I know that, for example, whether it's breast cancer, prostate cancer, there are certain type of blood exams that you can get. Also, when it comes to heart disease, you know, taking a look at your triglycerides, you know, your cholesterol levels. Is there something that you could take that could be preventative when it comes to diabetes?
Well, there are a lot of people out there with diabetes that do not recognize it. It's gone undiagnosed. So, you know, knowing what your blood sugar, your fasting blood sugar is, and better yet, having your doctor order a hemoglobin A1C test would be very helpful to know, because it's quite possible you could have diabetes or prediabetes and not really recognize that. So those are rather simple tests that any physician can easily order from a blood draw, and those would potentially give you an early sign that you need to start to pay attention to your diet and probably carbohydrates if those are not in the correct range.
So when it comes to these kind of diets, have you found there's a specific type of diet? I mean, you talk generally about low carbohydrates. The one that comes to mind is, for example, the paleo diet, but we also have heard the advantages of something like the Mediterranean diet, which does include some carbs.
Yeah, that's where the individual and personalized nature of nutrition needs to be considered. In general, the Mediterranean diet does quite well for many people. because it is a little lower in carb and higher in fat and focuses on a lot of unprocessed foods and includes omega-3 fatty acids, which we know are healthy. But for some individuals who are very insulin resistant or carb intolerant, they require a greater level of carb restriction than you would typically see in a Mediterranean diet. So that's where a paleo diet or a ketogenic diet may be necessary in order to completely reverse all the metabolic problems that come along with insulin resistance. So the exact level of carb restriction required to maintain health is really something that each person sort of needs to figure out for themselves. And it even changes within an individual. As people age, they generally become more carb intolerant as they become more insulin resistant. So it's a bit of a moving target, even within a person. It's something that, you know, may change over the lifespan.
Doctor, where did we go wrong along the way? You know, I think of, you go back to the turn of the last century when a lot more Americans lived on the farm and the things that we ate came directly from the farm. Today, you walk into a supermarket, aisle after aisle is probably processed foods. You know, we've been able to feed more people as the planet has grown and added more people to the planet. But by the same token, you take a look at the United States and you walk into our supermarkets, just about half the store or more is all processed.
This is not a simple problem that developed overnight, but I think you've put your finger on some of the important aspects of our obesity and diabetes problem. And that's, we did go down a path with modern agriculture and a lot of the processed now foods and grains that are in most of our food supply. That did allow us to feed a lot more people, but that's not the same as saying that those nutrients are ideal for everyone. And it's pretty clear now that we're over-consuming carbohydrates, in particular processed carbohydrates and starches and simple sugars, that the average human doesn't have the metabolic capacity to deal with. So that's a big part of it, and I think it's gone underappreciated because we've built an economy around carbohydrates. It's part of our culture. It's part of our politics now, and there are many lobbyists that have a stake in this. So it's more than just the science now and our understanding of what is ideal. There are many other, you know, factors that are contributing to our perpetuation of this idea that we need to have these carbohydrates in our food supply. So no simple answers other than, you know, getting the processed carbs out of our diet is a really good place to start for most people.
Doctor, what about the importance of supplements? I mean, you think before the 20th century, we didn't have things like vitamins. Most of the people that, you know, got all their nutrition directly from their food. Today, we are told that supplements are a very important part of good health and diet. Is there any truth to that? I mean, do these supplements, whether you're taking vitamin C, E, D, do they really help?
Well, I think there's isolated cases where supplements can have a role. I think we're having a lot of consistent research come out around vitamin D deficiencies or marginal deficiencies. So, you know, I think there's a pretty strong case that can be made for many individuals taking a vitamin D supplement. Many of us don't consume fish, especially deep water fish, so we may be marginally deficient in omega-3 fatty acids. So if that's the case, you know, taking a supplement makes a lot of sense. Some of us don't get good sources of calcium, so taking a calcium supplement is warranted in those instances. So it's really individual. I don't think there's a lot of great evidence that across the board we should be telling everyone they need to take vitamins and minerals, especially if they have a well-rounded diet that includes a lot of whole foods. So, you know, they can be used strategically depending on a person's dietary habits and, you know, their metabolism.
Doctor, is there a transitional period? Like, let's say that you're overweight, maybe you have issues with cholesterol, maybe you're pre-diabetic. Is this something that you make a gradual transition to, or is it something that you can start immediately with?
Well, for most people, this is something they can start immediately with. I do see some individuals gradually restrict the carbs and it works for them. But in most cases, you really don't experience the full benefits until you have restricted carbs quite a bit. So I usually recommend people go sort of cold turkey and get the carbs as low as possible, as soon as possible. And that really starts the adaptation process right away. And it does take a couple weeks for the body to switch over to burning more fat and not as much carbohydrate, which it's used to. And that 2-3-4 week process doesn't happen if you gradually restrict carbs. So it will take much longer to fully adapt then. So I generally recommend, you know, people educate themselves, you know, on which foods contain carbohydrate and which foods you're going to, you know, stock your cabinets and refrigerator with, and get all that in line first and then start the diet and kind of go right into it.
And doctor, is there one book out there that you would recommend that would give a person sort of the science, the background, the process of a low-carb diet?
There are several good books that have been written on low-carbohydrate diets, most of them from the, you know, practical side of, you know, how do you actually change your diet and what are the recipes you can use and meal plans and so forth. Fewer books that really teach people about the scientific rationale or basis for why a low-carb diet works that is geared more toward physicians. So I did write a book along those lines with my colleague Steve Finney a couple years ago called The Art and Science of Low-Carbohydrate Living, and that does deal a little more with the how and why it works. And then we wrote a follow-up book that's a little more geared toward the active individual or the athletes that really focused on the use of a low-carb diet for enhancing performance and recovery, which has a similar title. It's called The Art and Science of Low-Carbohydrate Performance.
And doctor, between those two, let's take an average American that goes to work, and let's take your athlete, that, let's say a professional, it could be a football, baseball player, or somebody training for the Olympics. Is there any difference in the low-carb diet that you would recommend between an athlete and a, just say, an ordinary Joe?
Well, it really depends on the person. In most cases, the athletes are not going to be using the diet so much to lose weight as a type 2 diabetic or an obese person would want to restrict total calories while they're restricting carbohydrates so that there's a negative energy balance and weight loss. The athlete would be using it for other reasons, you know, to shift over to burning fat and perhaps, you know, the anti-inflammatory effects of the diet, lower amounts of oxidative stress and so forth. So the diet would be higher in total calories, but perhaps similar in terms of the carbohydrate restriction. And that means it's higher in fat. So they end up eating a lot of fat in order to meet their energy requirements and still keep the carbs low. So there are some subtle differences, but in many ways the diet's very similar other than the total caloric value.
Doctor, would you recommend prior to going on a diet like this that perhaps the first thing you should start with as you start any kind of program is perhaps see your physician, get a blood test, and take a look at your blood chemistry levels and find out, you know, what's your cholesterol, what's your lipids and things like that, or what's your sugar levels?
Absolutely. It's always good to, you know where you're starting. So, you know, informing your physician that this is something that you want to try and getting some blood work, you know, to have a baseline, and then following up perhaps 12 weeks or 6 months later with additional blood work to see how you've responded in terms of various blood markers is a very good way to go forward with this.
So overall, doctor, you have found, at least in your years of study and looking at this, that the low-carb diet seems to make people healthier. You know, they take off weight, their blood chemistry levels, whether it's fats or looking at cholesterol, seems to turn out much better.
Especially for those who are obese or type 2 diabetic or pre-diabetic, the results are often transformative. I mean, it can be really remarkable where people have failed with low-fat diets and almost given up hope. The low-carb diet has had just transformative, extraordinary results in many, many cases.
Well, listen, I want to thank you for joining us on the program today. I appreciate all the good work that you have done along with your associate, and thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you, Jim.
You know, it's interesting, Jim, when I went to see the new doctor, we've got a concierge doctor. He's an interesting dude and takes a lot of time with you to understand what you're doing. And he said to me, this was a couple of years ago, you know, your body mass index is just a little higher than it should be. And I said, okay, doc, I got a proposition for you. I'll go on any diet that you want me to go on. There's only one stipulation. You have to guarantee me that it's going to work.
Oh, those are bad words in our industry, guarantee.
And he got real quiet, and I looked at him and I said, so shut up and don't ever bring it up again. I literally said it to him like that. I said, you guys are great at telling us we need to go on diets. I've tried every diet I can think of. And the one that really worked was the low carb and an alkaline diet. Last summer, I lost 16 pounds on it. Now, I gained some of it back in the wintertime. Because unlike where you are, Jim, we get cooped up a lot. And, you know, the only thing you have is indoor exercise. You can't get out and do stuff. But there are some diets that work. But he's right. You know, your guest was right. It is dependent upon the person. And everybody's body composition due to genetics and everything else is different as to how we react to things.
Yeah, it was amazing because about 4 or 5 years ago, I went into a men's dress store and I was getting some new pants and I told the guy what waist size. And this was back when I was probably eating a little bit too much and exercising too little. And he looked at me and said, sir, he says, I don't mean to offend you, but he said, you're not that size. And so I it was a nice way of saying, dude, you don't have that size waistband. So, you know, John, I decided, okay, I was going to get into shape. And I did what I always did before. I always controlled my waist size. Anytime I got a little heavy, I'd spend more time on the treadmill, maybe stay away from pizza, one of my favorite foods. And I started working out. And I started working out consistently, but I really wasn't losing weight.
Yeah, you don't lose weight, right?
Yeah, my trainer would say, well, you know, I was complaining to him, gosh, I'm doing all this workout. I'm doing the aerobics, the cardio, all this kind of stuff. I wasn't losing weight. He said, what are you eating? And I explained to him what I was eating. I said, well, there's your problem. And he suggested a couple books. And then I went to my doctor, talked to my doctor about it. And he said, absolutely. He was a big believer in the paleo diet because I had tried the vegetarian diet. I tried being a vegan. I tried the Atkins diet. And some will say paleo is just a variation of it. But John, you know, when I tried the paleo diet over the course of, I don't know, what was it, 6, 8 months, I lost over 20 pounds. And what I like about it, I don't have to measure. I don't have to say, okay, I'm going to have 3 meals a day, snacks in between, or measure the size. I just eat what I like to eat, and it's very good food, and it's healthy food. And the funny thing about it is, as you and I know, if you eat natural food, I don't care if it's vegetables, fruit, or lean protein, it's generally less costly than if you were going out to the grocery store and eating processed food.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. You have to find it, but you have to really want to do it. And I see so many people that need it, Jim. And my heart goes out to them because I know what it's like. You know, there's a hormonal change that happens in your 30s. And for men, it then becomes very difficult to lose weight. That's why I was chiding my doctor. I said, you know, you guys are great at telling us we should lose weight, but you can't tell us how.
And that's the amazing thing, I think, that happens to all of us, and especially those of you who are listening. Have you noticed that, you know, you sort of get in your 30s, you're not really doing anything different, but all of a sudden you start gaining weight, and it's your metabolic process is changing, it's slowing down, so there's so many things we need to do to counteract that. But anyway, folks, I hope you found this helpful, and especially for those of you that could be pre-diabetic, or even those that are in danger of heart disease. You might want to discuss this with your doctor and read up on it. There's plenty of books out there so you can find out for yourself. In the meantime, well, as always, we're out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.